The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
From Master Dogen's Shobo Genzo, the final section. Priest Baoche of Mayu was fanning himself. Monastic approached and said, "Sir, the nature of the wind is permanent, and there's no place it does not reach. Why then must you still fan yourself?" "Although you understand that the nature of wind is permanent," the master replied, "you do not yet understand the meaning of its reaching everywhere." "What is the meaning of its reaching everywhere?" asked the monastic. The master just fanned himself. The student bowed with deep respect. Dogen said, "This is the enlightened experience of Buddha Dharma and the vital way of its correct transmission. Those who say we should not use a fan because wind is permanent, and so we should know the existence of wind without using a fan, know neither permanency nor the nature of wind. Because the nature of wind is eternally present, the wind of Buddhism actualizes the gold of the earth and ripens the cheese of the long river." I have this idea, which is completely my own, that Dogen had this ending in mind from the very beginning. Of course, I don't know that. But there's something so exquisite. In a way, it's a very simple, short dialogue. But the way that it sort of brings the whole matter to hand. And remember that just before this passage, Dogen said, "Do not practice thinking that realization must become the object of one's knowledge and vision and be grasped conceptually." And he said, "Even though the attainment of realization is immediately manifest, its intimate nature is not necessarily realized. Some may realize it and some may not." In another passage, not in the Genjo Koan, but in another fascicle, he says that sometimes people realize it before knowing. Realization itself is, in a way, a very curious thing, which is why we're sitting in a training hall, not a classroom, why we're sitting on a diamond seat, not a desk. Because it can't be grasped conceptually. Remember that the Buddha, at the very beginning, after his enlightenment, said that he thought to himself, "How will I convey this to people? It's so subtle and can't be perceived by the senses," which is pretty much what we rely upon to know everything. And so then to think about how he came to that enlightenment himself, but then how, that's one thing, which is extraordinary enough, but then how to teach that. In a sense, how to come from the outside and enter into somebody else's mind, somebody else's person, and give them instruction in such a way that that will be conceptual, but helps them to move beyond that to realize, which in a sense is to come to know something that can't be known, to bring into cognition something that at the moment of contact is beyond cognition, but then comes in a, I don't know what the word is, mysterious way into knowing. And so when he said sometimes people realize it before knowing, maybe he meant that in that moment of realization, it's not yet known, but that's what realization is the moment where it comes into awareness, because otherwise, it's an experience that may be deep within a person, but it's not yet in their mind, right? And so in that sense, it's not something, you know, it's like when we have any kind of insight, all of the workings may be there, and we may have a subtle sense of something, but it's in the moment of insight that it becomes clear. In a sense, it comes into our field. And then we can begin to move forward with it, in a sense. That's why wisdom and compassion are inseparable, because wisdom, if you think of your Buddha body, wisdom is the Dharma body, the body that's free of characteristic and time and history and characteristics and attributes. But this body has no arms and legs. It can't move, can't function. Compassion is the coming forth. So that's why we practice the way we do. When Dogen says to forget the self, it's such a beautiful way of presenting it, because, you know, you can't make yourself forget something. The more you try and make yourself forget something, the more you're going to think of it, right? It's something that kind of slips away without knowing. But interestingly, we can practice in such a way that that slipping away becomes easier and easier, because we're releasing that muscle that is constantly trying to not forget this. So what Dogen is saying is that all things, all creatures, all people, at all times, in all circumstances, in every society, every culture, in every heaven and hell, each and every one immediately manifests their essential nature. Its intimate nature is not necessarily realized, right? I mean, that's clear. Some may realize it and some may not. I talked about that the other day in terms of sort of all the karmic and everyday conditions. But the thing that's important, I think, to remember or appreciate is that because everyone has Buddha nature, because it's so close, it's difficult to see, that we can, based on the teachings and our own assumptions, believe that certain conditions, we sort of create a certain condition or something, circumstance, situation, meditatively, that has to be present before this could even be possible. And that's just not true. Generally speaking, the more quiet, the more concentrated, the more deeper a person is in samadhi, the more sort of accessible it might be to gain insight. But that's not a rule. Not at all. And so it's important to appreciate that, because otherwise we can sort of close the door on just the possibility of just of seeing ourself in an instant, because we think, well, you know, this couldn't possibly happen. My mind's scattered, or I'm not deep enough, or I'm not close enough, and we should just flush those thoughts. Don't know. Some may realize it and some may not. So within the tyranny of samsara, which is rather tyrannical, you have two choices. You can win or you can lose. Which will it be? But when we free ourselves of that false and narrow view, then every step on the path is the path. And that's just the facts, friends. Whether you have faith in it or not, whether you believe it, whether you think that's a good idea or not, it's just the way things are. As Dada Roshi used to say, all the way to heaven is heaven itself. He used to also say, I'm going to take you there if I have to carry you on my back. He was joking. But if that's true, all the way to heaven is heaven itself, why can't we just be content with being in heaven? We're here. We've arrived. Don't take a step, the teachings say. Cross over to the other shore. You realize you haven't moved. Why not just save all this time and effort? Practice, live our lives. Why Zazen? Why Sishen? Why Ango? Why Shuso Hosen? You may be wondering that. Why all of this? And I would say, I hope you already know. You know why. I think Hogan says, he mentioned this the other day, when we step onto the path, I don't know who it was you were showing, but the walls and the windows of this house begin to shake, right? And the I think it's the Surangama Sutra, there's a passage that speaks to this, and the Buddha basically says, when that house begins to shake, Mara gets upset and is not just going to sit by and let you take this house down. Mara's going to raise hell at you and try and keep you, keep that house intact. In the Dhammapada, there's a passage where the Buddha said, I who have been seeking the builder of this house, failing to attain enlightenment, which would enable me to find this house builder, have wandered through innumerable births in samsara. To be born again and again is indeed dukkha. And, you know, contemporary practitioners sometimes wonder about this. Like, why did he want to stop returning in the traditional view of rebirth? Like, life is good, right? We like life. We actually don't want to, for the most part, leave it, right? We cling to it, which is really the basis of rebirth. It's grasping, right? But we also, not everyone by a long shot, but many people live kind of like gods. You hit a switch, light comes on. You turn a tap, water comes out. You get sick, you go to the doctor. You want food, you go buy it. And so, and you know, yes, there are unexpected trials and calamities. But why wouldn't we want to come back for this? Well, you could go back 2,500 years, or you don't have to go back that far. I've been rereading a book by Doris Kearns on Lincoln, and it's just amazing how many children people had back then and how few of them survived. And this is people who were wealthy, people who were poor. So living with life and death, experiencing life and death is an ongoing thing. Being subject to illnesses for which there was not much cure, or the cures you might not want. Think about having a toothache. Oh my God. Back then? And so the notion of, you know, life being blissful and wonderful and sweet may be a more contemporary, and it's still not true for so many. But so the Buddha is saying, I bound up in my attachments and false views, I kept returning to samsara. But then he goes on in the next verse to say, oh, house builder, you are seen. You shall not build this house again. All your rafters are broken. Your roof tree is destroyed. My mind has reached the unconditioned nirvana. The end of craving has been attained. So, of course, he's speaking about himself. The house builder has been seen through, has been realized. He's freed himself from the self who builds that house over and over again. And this brokenness, this destruction occurs when we just stop building the house. We realize there is no house to build. And so we shouldn't think of this as deconstruction. You know, you build a house, bricks and wood, now you got to pull out all the nails, chip away all the mortar. No. Just stop building it. I was thinking about when I grew up from the age of 2 till 17 or 18, my family lived in a house in Atlanta that was, I came to realize, very dear to me, dear to us. In fact, at one point, my parents said that they wanted to keep the house in the family, even if they didn't live there, just so we could have it. Anybody of the kids who wanted to live there could live there, because it was so much a part of us, you know? And then sometime later, we had to sell it because my parents were having financial trouble. We couldn't make the mortgage, and so we had to sell it. And I thought, I don't think I'd encountered the Dharma yet, but I was reading, and I had a sense of not attachment. I thought, it's just a house. I'm not attached. And then when we sold it, it was like, ugh, I felt heartbroken. And I remember my little sister, who was 10, 11 at the time, maybe a little older, she made a time capsule, you know, for some time in the future, and she put it up in the attic. And we had already moved. We'd been away, I don't know, a couple of weeks. And one day she decided she wanted to leave it there. She wanted to get it back. So she just went and walked in the house and went up to the attic. Because it was still her house, I guess, you know. She'd lived in it her whole life. She's coming down the stairs and she meets the lady of the house, and who says, honey, can I help you? And she said, no, I'm good. I just came to get this. The Buddha also said, even gorgeous chariots wear out, and this body wears out as well. But the Dharma does not age. Thus the good make it known to the good. That's how it's come down to us. The good have made it known to the good. Those who have realized it as true have shared it, have passed it on to those who are seeking. But because of this house that wears out just like a gorgeous chariot, what can we rely upon? We take refuge. What can we rely upon? So Priest Baoche was fanning himself. The student said, the nature of wind is permanent. There's no place it doesn't reach. Why do you still fan yourself? And that can be confusing because we think of nothing as permanent. Everything changes. But in this sense, permanent means permanent. And if something is permanent, it means it has never been born and has never died because it's permanent. It means it has never been constructed out of dependently arising conditions. And the only thing that exists as permanent is that which is unconditioned, unborn and undying. It doesn't abide anywhere. And so there is no place it does not reach. To bring it down to everyday life, when a thought arises in your mind, where does that come from? Where was it the moment before it came into your mind? In your thought chamber, vault, oven? And then there it is, clearly a thought. And then in some short moment, it will pass. Now, where does it go? It's like space, which is used so often as a kind of a metaphor for mind, for self-nature, boundless, unconditioned, permanent. You can't locate it. You can't touch it. And yet, wherever you look, there it is. So if this is so, the student wants to know, if the nature of wind is permanent, there is no place it does not reach. Why do you have to fan yourself? If it's permanent, it should always be there. It reaches everywhere. And so Baoche says, you understand the nature of wind is permanent, but you don't yet understand the meaning of its reaching everywhere. How is that? The student asks. And Baoche fanned himself. The student doesn't yet understand the nature of self-nature, the nature of things, how it appears in autumn and winter, spring and summer, how it brings laughter and tears, how it's the cause of suffering and the cessation of suffering, how it can kill and give life. Emptiness is form, form is emptiness. How many ways has this been spoken of in the 2,500 and more years, trying to convey something that words ultimately cannot. So the words get as close as they can. They reach, they bend, they crack and groan under the weight of their objectivity to try and communicate something. And they can only reach so far. We have to reach the rest of the way. They cannot give it to us. And so that's why Dharma practice is not about self-improvement or self-exchanging, exchanging yourself for a better one, trading it in, right? Newer model, self-transformation. All the while, something that appears very much like transformation is taking place, right? Who would deny it? In fact, in the Doshinji Code, there's a line that says, that part of being in training is to make progress. There will be a test tomorrow. There will, actually. What does that mean, progress? It means not being dead. It doesn't mean measuring, comparing. It means being alive, lively, practicing. What is the meaning of it reaching everywhere? Bao Che fanned himself. There's a story where Layman Pong was visiting a master and was leaving, so the teacher sent some of his monks to escort him out to the main gate. And it started snowing. And Layman Pong said, "Good snowflakes, they don't fall in any other place." And the student says, "Where do they fall?" And Layman Pong slapped him. And the student said, "Even a layman shouldn't be so coarse." I like that. Even a layman. And Layman Pong said, "Though you travel this path, the Lord of Death will not yet let you go." And interestingly, I just came across, Dada Roshi used to speak about lay people, lay practitioners, as home leavers. And I thought he just made that up. But the actual term is a staying home person, as opposed to a leaving home person. So a monastic is a home leaver, and a lay person within the vernacular is a staying home person, practitioner. Home dweller sounds nicer. So what is the reason, meaning of this reaching everywhere? That it doesn't fall in any other place. What does that mean? I remember a story Dada Roshi told years ago of in the very early days of Zen. A Japanese teacher was being interviewed. And somebody, and the interviewer was asking about the meaning of this and the meaning of that and the meaning of this. And finally he said, meaning, time to shut up and sit. Maizumi Roshi said, through activity, through practice, we can vitalize and actualize our nature. True nature itself is rather static. No arms and legs. We have to let it move. We have to let it revolve by our practice, by our activity. And again, I think Sean mentioned this the other day, we have to be careful with the language because language objectifies, right? So true nature becomes a noun or an adjective, a description of something. And so Maizumi Roshi says we have to vitalize it, actualize it, because it is static. We have to let it move. All of this language, right, which seems very much to be talking about something. And so as a practitioner, you just have to continually be correcting that in your mind, correcting that, so that the mind doesn't begin to see this as something that is something. And so he says we should know existence of the wind as the, for people who think that we, because it's permanent, we should know existence of the wind without the fan. And he's saying, no, the fan is essential. He's pointing to Genchō Kōn, the way of everyday life. And Zen takes this very seriously, very intently. It's through activity. And so, you know, to really appreciate, I mean, this is part of, you know, most meditation-based Buddhist traditions. But in the Zen tradition, it's very explicit, right? Walking, chanting, bowing, eating. I mean, look at what we do with a meal. It's one of the most elaborate ceremonies we have. To bring our attention to experience something as it is. And not just in its bare, you know, not projected mind, but in its wonder, in its magnificence. Maizumi says, this is the enlightened experience of Buddha Dharma and the vital way of correct transmission. And so that's why it's important to practice in all of our life circumstances. I mentioned this the other day. Different moments, different circumstances, different relationships, different times, in different mental and emotional states, in different stages of life, in different stages of society. Which just basically means keep practicing, because all of that stuff is changing. To practice in times of faith and doubt, when you're confident, when you're insecure, when you're humble, when you're arrogant, when you're on the path, when you've got lost, When is the time when we would not? When is the time when it's not important? And so, Sesshin, Ango, daily practice. I came across this passage from a Mahayana sutra that I wasn't familiar with, in which a queen is facing her people, and they love her queen, their queen. And she's feeling that, and she's filled with gratitude. And the sutra says that that is more meaningful to her than if she was going to have power over multiple worlds, or if she was going to hold power for immeasurable eons. And the sutra said, it's just like when a person who acts out of craving, despair, wanders into the wilderness and is separated for a long time from their parents, their siblings, their friends, their companions, their sangha. And that person wants to reconnect. They want to see them, but they become so distant. If they were to meet them again, they would feel great bliss and affection, and they wouldn't be able to get enough of seeing them. And the sutra said, it's like that for this queen. In the same way, she felt great bliss and enthusiasm as soon as she saw the people in her community. She experienced mental satisfaction and happiness. She had wonderful thoughts and exalted enthusiasm. She thought of them as her only children. She thought of them as her parents. She thought of them as worthy of honor. She thought of them as her spiritual teachers. She thought of them as beautiful. She thought of them as rare. She thought of them as people who do difficult things. She thought of them as accomplishing a lot. She thought of them as supremely helpful. She thought of them as the basis for the path of awakening. And she thought of them as her own teachers and instructors. It's the love of the bodhisattva. That's our natural heart, mind, compassion. That when it's not burdened, constrained, constricted, fearful, limited, it just naturally comes forth. And that takes time. And so we give it a little push. We do metta practice. We do the four immeasurables. We take care of each other. We bow and return that bow. We serve each other. We do all kinds of things to try and make it clear what we're in the midst of. Those who say we shouldn't use a fan because wind is impermanent, and so we should know the existence of wind without using a fan, know neither permanency nor the nature of wind. Because the nature of wind is eternally present, your nature, self-nature, Buddha nature, the nature of all things. So then, the wind of Buddhism actualizes the gold of the earth and ripens the butter of the long river. When I read it before, I read it as cheese. It means some dairy product. It does. And the long river is the Milky Way. So the wind of Buddhism actualizes the gold of the earth, right? Brings forth the treasure, the beautiful, luminous, gorgeous, rare, of great value of the earth, and ripens the butter, the cheese, the yogurt of the long river. Brings it all forth. It reveals the beauty, the intricacy, the simplicity. You know, Hogan Sensei mentioned something the other day that I thought about, something I have thought about before. He said something like, that when we practice, sometimes that causes harm to people. And I just want to say a little bit more about that from my own perspective. You know, I think for most of us, when we begin practicing, it's very personal. Like, I am drawn to the Dharma, you are drawn to the Dharma, you seek, you pursue, you study, you come to a place like this, you begin meditating, right? It's something that you're engaged in, it's meaningful to you, something in you is moving, right? But to realize that when we do that, it's affecting other people around us. And in a way, you could say that anything we do is like that, but not quite the same. Even going to church, which is a good thing, but for many people, it seems, you go to church and then you come home and life resumes. But as a practitioner, in a sense, you bring church home. You bring it home. You make it in your house. You have a place, a pew for yourself, right? A seat. You have an altar and chapel. You're the officiant, right? You're doing the holy communion of Buddhism. You're sacralizing. You're meditating. And all of that is very interior. It's like a radical kind of interiorizing, right? That needs to come out. There needs to be a fan. Bao Che needs to fan himself to get cool. But to appreciate how everybody in our field is on some level experiencing that and having their own experience of that, right? And you may share that with them. They may talk about it with you. And you get a little bit of insight. They might get a little bit of insight, a little bit of insight into what that is for you. But there's also a lot that you can't know in terms of what's going on for them, because it's feeling. It's things that they may not even recognize. And certainly there's a lot that they can't know that's going on for you. How would you speak of it? And because it's such a practice of devotion, you're devoting your heart, mind, and time, right? You go to sit, so you're not hanging out with the others. You come here. You're not at home this week. If there are people at home, they feel that, I'm assuming. And they're not like, good, get the hell out of here for a week. Don't they have 2 weeks of issues? You leave, right? If you have kids, what's that like? So it's kind of a big deal. It's a living thing. It's not just once a week for a couple of hours. It's like every day. And it's permeating. That's the point, is that it permeates. And everybody else is going to have their own view of that, their own experience of that. Some may like it, some may not. Some may support it, some may not. Some may understand, even if they don't really care for it. I think sometimes people in a person's life who may not sort of have some kind of interior something, some sort of way of turning in, being quiet, some sort of reflective aspect of their life, sometimes really don't get it. I remember I have a family member who was like, I just don't get it. Why don't you just like live? I was like, yeah. Why don't I? Why don't we all? This is how. And so just to appreciate, if we haven't, and I'm sure there are ways in which everybody does, because you probably hear about it from other people. But it's not, it's subtle. It's more than just time away, but it's like something that you're doing is getting inside of them. And so we can think of that, as Hogan suggested, that ways in which they might not like that. They may miss you when you're gone. They may wish you could be more there, when you're doing your sitting or studying, art practice, body practice. It's like Ango heaps it on, So like, you're excited about Ango and they're not? Hopefully they're seeing good things, and that helps to affirm that this is a good thing to help balance out. I've even talked to some students whose children, shifted such that, there are times where they say, Mom, you really should go to Seishin. You're getting kind of grouchy. But another way is think about providing an example without trying. Not because you think you're something special. Not because you think practicing makes you more special than somebody else. But just simply because you're doing it and it's sincere. And that is felt. Like we feel insincerity, right? We're seeing it everywhere. Don't you feel that? Hell yeah. And so when somebody is sincere and is engaged into something in a very deep, heartfelt way that requires consistency and perseverance, and they see that sometimes it's not easy, right? And you come back and they say, did you have a wonderful, calm, and peaceful retreat? And sometimes you say yes, and sometimes you say no. And they're like, what's that about? But you know. And to dedicate, I mean, people do that in all walks of life. When somebody wants to go very deep into one thing, it could be science, it could be the arts, it could be anything. That time's going to come from somewhere. It's going to be borrowed from someone. Family, children, partners, friends. That's the way it works. That's the way deep things happen. And so it's just good for us to, I think, be aware of that and be sensitive, you know? And so that means sometimes, you know, compromising, being flexible, responding, taking care of those who need your attention when it's time to do that, right? And having that flexibility. I mean, I think of a child growing up in a house with parents who were, I mean, when I grew up, my parents loved us, but they also made it clear we were not the absolute center of their world. And that was kind of a good thing, right? And for a child to grow up seeing a parent sit down and do something that they may not understand, but they keep seeing them do it, and just the visual image of somebody meditating is very powerful. Why do people put stone Buddhas in their yards and not when they're not Buddhists? It evokes something. And so to think of those impressions coming into a child's mind, I don't know what that does, but I think it must have some good. So we're coming to the end of our celebration of our 45th year. We even had a party, right? During the middle of Ango. And I drew some of this from the introduction to building the Seamless Temple. Heavenly Light Mountain, building a seamless temple, Doshinji, the way of reality. 45 years of thousands of hands and eyes of Kenon Bodhisattva, hearing and responding to the cries of the world. Dedicated sentient beings walking an enlightening path while still subject to our attachments and false views. It's always been like that. Indebted to a profoundly committed teacher who was building a great vessel while sailing it and inviting others on board in calm and stormy waters. It's always been like that. And this vessel requires practitioners at every stage of the path. Requires those just entering, those a few to many years, those who've come for some time, then move on, those who come and practice throughout their lives, those who become seniors, those who ordain, those who live the noble and complete life as a monastic, those who teach. We are in the midst of and are active participants in the momentous transmission of Buddha Dharma from east to west, and very specifically from lineages steeped in hundreds of years of Indian, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, Tibetan, Southeast Asian traditions and cultures down to this time and place. That's a big deal, because it's not in a text. It has to be carried and transmitted through people, through bodies and minds, living, practicing, doing what we're doing, having done what we're doing all the way back. And so to be a practitioner, as I said to somebody earlier this week, and in light of how this affects others, in a way, you have to go your own way. Every practitioner has to decide if they're going to engage the Dharma, and in a way, you're making a decision, a solitary decision, a very intimate decision that's going to have impact. That's why we do it. In ways that we recognize, in ways we don't. And to be courageous in that, to be confident in that, to be caring and sensitive in that. And in a sense, to know what you need to do and to keep knowing that. because we can forget, to keep bringing it forward, in a sense, to protect it, right? There's a sense of the fierce guardian in Buddhism protecting bodhicitta. And what makes all of that unselfish? Why is that not just selfish? And maybe you've been asked that question. Isn't this selfish? It's really important to be clear on that, each of us. What makes it unselfish? If going your own way is the path of letting go and realizing the emptiness of you, of the basis of selfishness and self-clinging, of going the way of Buddhas and ancestors, it's not selfish. And people may not understand how and why it's necessary to go so deeply into your body and mind in order to bring forth great compassion. But hopefully you know. And so let us try not to let our practice be something that divides and creates conflict, and at the same time, be committed to it. Maizumi Roshi said, through the wondrous art of Zazen, you begin a peaceful revolution, but not without some tears. It's good to be told the truth, isn't it? Just from the beginning. I found that so refreshing. Ojin Sensei gave me a little journal that she found of Dada Roshi's that from way back, before he was even here, going all the way back into the 70s, just little bits and pieces, fragments of poems and reflections. And so I wanted to conclude with a short poem of his from 1983, the fall of 1983, another Ango. This autumn mountain, it's no small thing to be born human. This autumn mountain, it is no small thing to be born human.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.